From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, a couple of interesting features we got going on. That's Dr. Robin Walker, who's a pediatrician and past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society section on pediatric environmental health. He's going to be talking about some headlines that were made. There was a CBC News article and some 6 o'clock news talking about this big meta study that had been done declaring that, or at least as far as the news anchors were concerned, that that organic food was no better for you than other food. However, one of the listservs that I pay attention to, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, or CAPE, which I think is a great name, by the way, it pretty much exploded with physicians and doctors and scientists who completely said that this was being misrepresented, and this is not at all what the study said. So I managed to get Dr. Walker on the line to explain exactly what was wrong with how this study was being presented and how that is not at all what the study was saying. So we get a little bit of information about organic food and about pesticides in the first half with Dr. Robin Walker. In the second half, we will be hearing from Dr. Tushar Mehta. We have a very prestigious group of guests today, I suppose. Tushar Mehta, who's started the part of a new group called Run for the Earth. They're a new environmental group that wants to bring a greater public focus to the root cause of all environmental problems, overconsumption. They also have an event that's coming up, which is a parade for actually September the 9th if you're in Toronto, and is same day as the Toronto Vegetarian Association Food Festival. So lots going on this weekend if you happen to be in Toronto. We'll enjoy it for you if you happen to be not in Toronto. All this and more will be learned, however, coming up after. Are we starting with international headlines today, Leah?
Yep, yes, we are.
International headlines. We're after your international headlines. Take it away, Leah Mazzolini.
Thanks, Darren. It's been over a month after wastewater from a major copper mine has allegedly began making certain Peruvian communities sick, and now international press has begun pushing for answers. Up to 6 miles of the Amazon River has tested positive for a toxic cocktail of heavy metals. Citizens have been pointing at mining company Antamina's project as a source and are also claiming the government has done little to help parents of poisoned children. Peruvian environmental officials met with press and discussed the test results and claimed that inadequate medical care on Monday, September 3rd. Environment Minister Manuel Pulgar Vidal admits that accusations are slow to the reaction of the incident, but says that they're in the midst of changing their policies. Pulgar Vidal adds that they're pressing to double the fines for polluters to over $26.5 million. He calls for the top penalty for Antamina. Antamina is the world's third largest zinc mine and the eighth biggest producer of copper. According to a new report released on Wednesday, September 5th, future food prices are greatly being underestimated due to excluding climate change factors. International agency Oxfam predicts massive price spikes will affect the world's poorest people, who today spend up to 75% of their income on food. Data points to how extreme weather events such as droughts and floods could drive up future food prices. Previous research only tends to concern gradual impacts such as increasing temperatures and changing rainfall patterns. The research also finds that even under a conservative scenario, another U.S. drought in 2030 could raise the price of corn by up to 140% over the average price of food that year. Drought and flooding in southern Africa could increase the price of coarse grains by as much as 120%. Oxfam's climate change policy advisor, Tim Gore, warns that the world needs to realize that there are potential drastic consequences facing the food system because of climate change and should be an issue with greater priority amongst all nations. The United Nations says there's a spike of the misuse of chemicals, causing health and environmental damage, especially in emerging markets. A UN Environmental Program, or UNEP, report released on Wednesday, September 5th, says that governments need to do much more to carry out a promised cleanup by 2020. The production and use of chemicals from plastics to pesticides is moving to developing nations where safeguards are often weaker. In a statement, the UNEP says poisonings from industrial and agricultural chemicals are among the top five leading causes of death worldwide, contributing to more than a million deaths every year. The report adds that chemicals are ubiquitous in the consumer products, and scientists have only assessed the risks of using a fraction of the estimated 140,000 chemicals used worldwide. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. Very aptly chosen headlines today as we're talking about organic food, pesticides, and overconsumption. It's almost as if we planned it, but we didn't. That just happens to be the international news this week. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with Dr. Robin Walker, who's a pediatrician and going to be talking about a misrepresented report, according to him and many of the other members of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, saying that organic food is no better than other food. He's going to break down exactly how that study was misunderstood right after this music break.
The way I feel when I'm in your arms says unbelievable, and the way I feel when I kiss your lips says that I can't take back, and that I wouldn't even if I got the chance. 'Cause even though I'm not allowed, I'll keep crawling back as long as you let me in. Self-control is not a factor, 'cause when I'm with you, it disappears. Even though I'm not
All right, and we are back. That was a local musician, Macy Paquette, with Not a Factor. Friend of the show, newly friend of the show, but she may be listening as well. So if you enjoyed that track, I believe that you can find her simply by Googling her name. It's Macy, M-A-C-C-I-E, P-A-Q-U-E-T-T-E. Thank you very much for sending that in. As a note to other people as well, if you're a local musician, I won't guarantee to play your music because I have to like it first. But feel free to send in stuff. We're always happy to support local musicians, local being anywhere in Canada, really. So if you have something you'd like us to play, to consider to play anyway, feel free to send that into thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We're going to go now, however, to our first feature, which was Dr. Robin Walker, who's the past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society Section on Pediatric Environmental Health and a pediatrician himself. No surprise there. There was a fair bit of news the other day. It was 6 o'clock news, and I know it made it on the CBC and a couple other places about a big meta study that had been done that declared, at least as far as the point of view of the reporters, that organic food was no better for you than kind of quote-unquote regular food. Dr. Walker and I agreed that this was incorrect. Well, he's the one that said it was incorrect. We agreed that this was likely not due to any type of slant or spin, but just another example of why you should really support shows like The Green Majority, because a lot of the people who are just covering these things are just not... they're regular reporters. They have journalism degrees, but they don't have degrees in science or the environment or anything else like that. And they're just, you know, they just don't have the expertise to understand them. So we managed to find an expert who's gonna explain this issue for us. So take it away, Dr. Robin Walker. We will be speaking to Robin Walker. Robin Walker is a pediatrician and past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society Section on Pediatric Environmental Health. My apologies. Welcome to The Green Majority, Robin Walker. I got an email in my listserv, one of hundreds a day that I get, but this one caught my attention because it was talking about a potentially misunderstood study talking about organic food. I've been coming across studies for years and years, and in some of my classes this issue came up again, where it seems like one study comes out and says that organic food is fantastic for you, the next one comes out and says that it's a total waste of money. So you had weighed in on how you thought that this, not that the study was incorrect, but that it had been reported improperly. Would you mind just describing a little bit what the story was talking about here?
Yeah, sure. So what I and other subscribers to this listserv had seen was one of a variety of news reports on a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is a major medical journal, and that study was published earlier this week, and it was what is called a systematic review of the literature on the nutritional value of organic food. Now, a systematic review, just to make this clear, is a way to look at a mass of literature, a large number of research studies, and pool them together in a very systematic and sort of protocolized way, so that you can pull all the evidence from all of those studies together and try to come to some conclusions. And the reason for doing this is that studies often have different findings on the same subject, but if you put good studies together, then often the conclusions you'll reach will be more powerful than if you try to interpret the studies individually.
So just for clarity... I was going to say, just for clarity, this is something where this comes up a lot with issues around like climate change, for instance, and so others. So just to be clear, this is the methodology they use is something like maybe like grouping studies that have similar methodologies and ranking them by authority and stuff like that.
That's exactly right. Now, one of the uses of systematic reviews, of course, is where conclusions are hard to reach and studies come up with different conclusions. And one of the problems often is that the studies actually don't have similar methodology or don't ask similar questions. So you can do a systematic review, and I have done systematic reviews myself. And sometimes it's a challenge to actually do that analysis and put them all together because they are actually all so different. And in this particular systematic review, there was some of that difficulty. So that can obviously affect the strength of the findings that come out of such a systematic review.
Okay, so what the story had been talking about that you and some others had said that you didn't entirely agree with was the idea that now this you'll have to spell out for me a little bit. There's non-organic food had 30% more multi-antibiotic resistant bacteria, and non-organic food had 30% more pesticides. Can you break that down and kind of spread that out for us a little bit, just so we understand what they're talking about?
Sure. And the point and the point of debate here, if you like, was that the news reports concentrated on the study author's conclusion that their systematic review of the literature had not shown significant nutritional advantage to organic foods. But exactly as you have said, if you actually go to the study or the systematic review and read the whole thing and read the author's own conclusions, there were two parts to those conclusions. They weren't able to show nutritional advantage to organic foods, but they did show significant differences in the levels of certain contaminants, as you have described. And so the question, of course, is why does one eat organic food? For some people, it might well be a belief that they are nutritionally superior. For others, it may well be that they want to reduce the risk of harm from these kind of environmental contaminants. And my comment to the listserv had been, I had never necessarily known whether organic foods were nutritionally superior. I'm not saying they're not, but certainly I didn't know of any evidence that they were. But I still felt that it was worthwhile protecting particularly my children from harm by using organic foods whenever possible, because I did want to reduce their exposure to pesticides, to antibiotics used in animals, and so on.
So I think there's a few really interesting parts here to break down. The first one I'd like to ask you about was I speak to many people who try and buy as much organic food as possible, and they all are pretty adamant about the fact that they can taste the difference, and it's very easy to tell when something's organic and when it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with things like this, where from a user end user point of view, it seems pretty easy to tell the difference between organic and non-organic. Why do you think, or why do you know why there's been such trouble kind of nailing down whether in fact it is more quote-unquote nutritionally valuable or not?
Well, one of the issues here is that you will only be able to assess what you measure. So what constitutes nutritional superiority? I've had a very nice dialogue as a result of this listserv conversation with someone who's involved in the organic food industry, and who made the point that most of the studies that look at nutritional value of foods look at only a very few components of the food. So, I mean, we know, in the face of an obesity epidemic, that food that is high fat, high sugar, is not nutritionally as good as food that is low-fat, low-sugar, to be very simplistic. But when we're talking about the difference between organic and non-organic food, we're not talking about crude measures of that kind. You would have to start to look at much more subtle components, like, is there a difference in the richness of the mineral content? Is there a difference in the vitamin content? And so on. So most of these studies, in fact, the systematic review actually looked at close to 300 studies. Of those 300 studies, the vast majority looked at levels of contaminants or levels of nutrients, but the number of contaminants and the number of nutrients they looked for were really quite limited, and they were different in each study, which is one of the reasons why the study authors are quite cautious in their conclusions. And interestingly, to me, because I think the ultimate point is, does it make a difference to your health as an outcome whether you eat organic or not? Only three of the studies actually looked at any kinds of health outcomes. And those health outcomes they chose to look at were very, very short-term, mostly allergic symptomatology like asthma or other very short-term outcomes. They didn't make any attempt to look at long-term outcomes, which may actually be much more important when you're talking about environmental contaminants. For example, I've written on the link between certain pesticides and diseases such as cancers and leukemias and lymphomas. And those kinds of outcomes, of course, you can only see after very, very many years, even decades.
Right. So just, I guess, to give people a really clear example of what we're talking about why this is such a difficult area to study, would it be fair to say this is similar as it would be similar to go to your doctor and say, am I well or not?
And
well, that depends what you're looking at. You know, this, how much of this do you have? How much of that do you have? There's, you can only find, certain, say, viruses or certain disorders if you specifically know what you're looking for and go looking for it and all these sorts of issues. Is that relatively the same idea?
And that's exactly right. And furthermore, what one always has to point out, and this isn't always easy for non-scientists to understand, is that absence of proof is not proof of absence. So if I can explain that, when we say that we don't have evidence to support a conclusion, that is not the same thing as saying that there is evidence that that something is not true. So when this study says they were not able, from this systematic review of the literature, to tell if the organic food is more nutritious than non-organic, that isn't the same thing as saying definitively that there is no difference. What it is saying is that on the basis of the currently available literature, they're not able to tell the difference. So we don't have proof that one is better than the other based on this current study, but until there are more studies that look at that richness of content of all the nutrients, we won't be able to definitively say that there's a difference in nutrition between organic and non-organic. We can't say at the moment that there is a superiority of one over the other, but that doesn't mean that it's proved that there is no difference.
Is that fair to say that's this sort of same difference as saying that it's the difference between guilty and not guilty rather than guilty and innocent?
That's a very good way of putting it, yes. Yes.
We can say they're not guilty, but that doesn't mean that they're innocent because you haven't established positive proof in the opposite direction.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that essentially is what the study authors concluded. They did not say that what they had proved was that there was no difference. They did say that on the basis of this review, they couldn't at this point in time ascertain that there was a nutritionally significant difference.
Okay, so you were admittedly not a nutritionist; you're a pediatrician. So falling more under your expertise is the other half of this, where we're talking about non-organic food being 30%. I'm not sure I understand that because there's not supposed to be pesticides on organic food at all, I guess. But maybe you can make that out for me. But the idea of pesticides and pesticides being a harm specifically to children and developing bodies is something we do know is definitely negative. So there's no question about that. Do you want to break down that a little bit and just explain what they meant by that 30% more pesticides?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, the issue here, of course, is that even food that is produced organically may not be totally pesticide-free. Let me put it this way. If a farmer in the next field is using pesticides and you're growing organic food in the next field, there's no guarantee that some of that won't come over, or that there will be pesticides in the water supply that you use to irrigate plants, and so on and so forth. So there's no guarantees that any food is totally pesticide-free. You can only say that food produced properly according to organic principles should be much lower. Now, certainly, as a pediatrician and specifically as a neonatologist, so that means a specialist in newborns, I am very interested in not only the long-term effects of pesticides and other substances on disease, but also on their impacts on development. So many of the concerns about environmental contaminants in the very young child are not only that they may predispose that child to later diseases, perhaps even in adulthood, like, say, cancers, just as an example, but also that they may have an impact on the development of the child's immature and developing organ systems. So to give a couple of examples of these two types of effects, We worry about the pesticide 2,4-D, which is very commonly used on lawns, for example, because there is, I think, fairly significant evidence that it may be associated with certain types of lymphomas, notably non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which tend to present in late youth or young adulthood. But as an example of the other approach, phthalates, which are used in plastics, have been associated with maldevelopment of the reproductive system. So they don't necessarily cause disease. They may do that too, but in this example, the concern in young children is also related to their impact on a developing organ system, in this case, the reproductive system.
Does that include stuff like bisphenol A that we've covered several times in the program?
It absolutely includes bisphenol A. Bisphenol A was banned from baby bottles in Canada, to our credit, was unusually the first country in the world to do that, although others have now followed suit, because of a concern about the impact of bisphenol A on development. BPA is an endocrine disruptor, and therefore through mimicking the action of human hormones can impact on the development of human organ systems. It may have other effects too, but that was the particular one that led the Canadian government to take this particular action.
Mm-hmm. And so with that, I mean, it's pretty much as soon as there was a lot of attention and Canada moved forward to ban bisphenol A, as you said, the same sort of groups that were following that, particularly groups like Environmental Defense, for instance, that it was spending a lot of time and energy working with that issue, had immediately moved on to something else, it seemed, no more than like 5 minutes later, about some other chemicals and stuff. So, I mean, we sort of hear about these contaminants and phthalates and stuff that get into that affect developmental disorders and whatnot. It feels like it's just one after the other. I mean, is there an endless list of these things that we need to one at a time kind of remove from our environment, or what's going on here?
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that is the reality. I was for a while involved in some of the committees that have been working on Canada's chemicals management plan, and I forget the exact number of chemicals that are being studied through that plan, but I think it's of the order of 40,000. So, you know, yes, the reality is that there is an almost endless stream of substances that we use nowadays in our daily lives, that industry produces for all kinds of purposes, and which can become contaminants in our bodies. And that's some of the complexity of studying this. First of all, you have this almost endless number, and even with all the scientists in the world, it's very hard to study every single one. And then secondly, you unquestionably will have some that may be perfectly safe and others which will have significant effects. And then thirdly, some of the effects that matter most in childhood are effects that won't become manifest for years or decades. And so studying to find a link between those later effects and the offending agent in childhood is incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, a lot of these don't present for quite some time, so you know, we may not even realize, you know, by the time we realize that something, you know, like bisphenol A, for instance, has been in baby bottles for years, not only is it's sort of too late to stop it, but you know, we have 30 years worth of children that have already been exposed.
Absolutely.
And so is there any sort of sense of what a way forward here is, rather than, because I mean, it seems like, you know, we're sort of making the public aware of it and educators, both physicians and scientists and environmental activists, are kind of bringing these things up one at a time and drawing attention to them. But it seems like for every one, you know, that's brought attention to it, there's 15 more that come out of the woodwork. So, I mean, is this a losing battle? Is there a better strategy? What's the way forward to deal with these sorts of health issues?
Well, and this takes us right back to the original subject of whether or not one should bother with the trouble and expense of trying to go organic in food. What I counsel parents on is that I'm certainly not one of those in the environmental movement who tries to suggest that everything is harmful And that there is proof necessarily of that harm for, you know, 40,000 chemicals, say. But recognizing that some of them certainly have been shown to be harmful, and others that may not yet have been shown to be harmful very likely are, it seems to me to make sense to have a strategy whereby you avoid unnecessary exposure to chemicals, particularly for young developing children, wherever you can. And there are some very simple ways of doing that. There's a wonderful website that's produced by the Canadian Partnership for Child Health and the Environment, CPCHE, C-P-C-H-E, and if you Google it, you'll find it very easily. And they have a publication which basically gives you half a dozen very simple tips for how you can reduce exposure of children to potentially harmful chemicals. They know more than I are saying that these are all proven to be dangerous. They're simply saying that you reduce exposure where you can, and that's going to reduce the potential harm from these agents about which we still don't know enough. And one of those approaches, of course, is to consider organic food, not because it has better nutritional value, it may or may not, we just really don't know yet, as this study said, but because organic foods demonstrably, in the studies that have looked at this, do have lower levels of pesticides and other contaminants that may well be harmful to developing children. So that, to me, is a good reason for considering organic food if you have young children, even if we don't yet have the absolute scientific proof of the benefit.
It's clearly better for you in some respects, and obviously you described why the jury might still be out on some other respects, but I think it's pretty safe to say that we can say it's not bad for you. Is that fair?
Well,
that
I think that's the point, isn't it? I mean, sometimes we are trying to make choices between, you know, the lesser of two evils, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. But in this case, there's not only is there no evidence that organic food might be worse for you, but it's scientifically implausible that it should be. So the possibility that particularly for a vulnerable population like young children, that it may reduce the potential for what could turn out to be significant harm seems to be quite sufficient of an argument to justify trying to go organic when you can.
We posted a picture on our Facebook page that we kind of had a clever idea around the, you know, seeing as food has always been produced naturally, like the original food was grown was organic food. So why should organic food be the one to have the burden of an additional label? We should just call it food.
Actually, that's ironic, but it's a good point. And I mean, it also speaks to the irony that for many, many of these substances, the burden of proof really is sort of on those of us who want to suggest that you reduce harm to prove that they're harmful. You know, yeah. As a physician, of course, I know that the approach to medications and therapies is that they have to be shown beyond, you know, a reasonable doubt to be safe and effective before they can be put on the market. And yet for almost everything else, and certainly for all of these 40,000 chemicals, the approach has really tended to be, you know, use them as you wish and then wait for 40 years to see if someone can show that they're actually unsafe.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got a lot of work still cut out for us, Robin. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on The Green Majority. Again, that was Robin Walker, past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society section on pediatric environmental health and pediatrician himself. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. Green Majority is produced live at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto every week with the hard work and dedication of our team of volunteers. We're broadcasting on at least 17 campus and community stations in cities across the country, from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. You can listen live nationwide on channel 826 of the Shaw Direct Satellite Network or channel 946 of the Rogers Digital Channel platform. And you can also get an audio copy for the time being by paying attention to our Facebook fan page, because our website is currently unavailable. But we do post links to the shows after the show on the Facebook page. So jump on there as well. Also, a random assortment of amusing or inspiring pictures and memes that I throw up there from time to time when they come across my desk. Don't forget that we love to hear feedback from our listeners as well. If you have comments or suggestions about the show, you can write to us at our email, thegreenmajority@gmail.com. Again, also via our Facebook fan page if you prefer. And you can also jump on our Twitter feed, which is @GreenMajority. There we post links to Canadian environmental news stories, so a good way to stay up to date on news in Canada and around the world on environmental topics. However, we're going to go now to our national headlines. We're joined by Vanessa Purdy.
Thank you, Darren. The Nature Conservancy of Canada announced that it has until mid-December to confirm a $15.2 million deal to purchase almost 60% of Coburn Island in hopes of preserving the pristine ecosystem there. Although part of the forest was logged in the late 19th century, it grew back naturally after that. The portion of that the Conservancy hopes to buy belongs to an American-owned business, Huron Timber Company, that has thus far left much of the forest intact. The island's only residents, the Jibah Hasing First Nation, have no outstanding land claim on the area the Conservancy plans to purchase. The Nature Conservancy is a nonprofit organization that acquires land and manages it with Conservancy goals in mind. In the case of Coburn Island, they would protect the land from large-scale quarry operations such as those on Manitoulin Island. A representative also said they might consider implementing a trail for the public. On Wednesday, September 5th, Environment Minister Peter Kent released the federal government's emissions regulations to curtail greenhouse gases from the coal-fired electricity sector. The regulations are proposing that new coal plants be only permitted if they emit less than 420 tons of carbon dioxide per gigawatt hour of electricity created. This amount is more than the earlier proposed 375. As well, units would get an additional 5 years to reach their targets, moved up to 50 years from the initial 45. Environmental groups expressed concern that these final regulations represent a significant weakening of the initial proposal. Peter Kent, however, says that they still meet 2020 targets and enable businesses to work towards them within the current economy. Canada's 2020 target is a reduction of emissions by 607 megatons. Bill Montevecchi, a Newfoundland Labrador scientist, said earlier this week that gannets, a type of duck, are engaging in a shocking new behavior. The birds, who should be nesting at Cape St. Mary's, have sought cooler waters and abandoned their chicks as a result. The phenomenon was noticed earlier this month, but according to Montevecchi, since then, there have been many gannet sightings off the coast of Labrador and even further north. It appears that the birds are searching for food as a result of an increase in local water temperatures by 3 to 4 degrees higher than normal. Wildlife officials say that the abandoned chicks are at risk of starvation as well as attack from other adult birds, and they cannot say for sure if the gannets have left for good or if they plan to return to their young. That's all for today's national headlines. I'm Vanessa Purdy.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. I would also like to offer a general apology on behalf of the Green Majority for generally consistently butchering First Nations and Indigenous. Certainly not only Vanessa. I think we've all had a turn at butchering that. So if you happen to be First Nations or Indigenous and would like to volunteer to help us correct our pronunciation, we're more than welcome to take that input, and I do apologize in general. However, leaving that behind, moving on, we're now going to talk to Dr. Tushar Mehta, who's joining us to talk about a new group that he's part of here called Run for the Earth. Do I have you on the line there, Dr. Mehta?
Yes, you can call me Tushar.
Thank okay, you. Tushar. So you contacted us because you had a new group and you have an event coming up soon. I'd first like to start, let's find out a little bit about who you are. You're a family physician, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And so that's a little bit of a left step for you might think at first glance, to have you starting an environment group. So why don't you explain that your interest in the environment just there to start?
Sure. Yes, I am a physician. I practice family medicine. I do some addictions work, and nowadays I'm doing mostly emergency medicine, actually. That's my sort of main job at the moment. I became a doctor because I was interested in helping people and just, you know, compassionate activities, and this was a job that seemed where I could do that kind of thing. But, I do a little bit of international work as well. I do work in India once a year, and I'm interested in youth in Canada. I do some work with Project Canoe But I've also been very interested in environmental issues all of my life. So, you know, in addition to being a physician, I've continued that interest for a long time and tried to find gradual ways of getting involved in helping in that respect.
Okay, so your new group is called Run for the Earth, and who's the intended audience, I guess, of this? Are you looking for general public participation in this group? Is this just for physicians? Who's the target audience?
The target audience is everybody. So we want to get everybody involved, and the Run for the Earth name, we wanted to organize an event that would attract people and get a lot of participation and get the word out about what we want to do. So the event is sort of a means to the end. We want to get people to participate, but our main sort of aim is actually discussing environmental issues and sort of reframing environmental issues in people's minds. So the event is actually to sort of cause a splash, get people out, and attract attention.
Okay, and it says here it's a parade, not a run specifically. So just
that is correct. It's our first year. We couldn't actually get a permit for having both a walking group and a running group, so we chose the walking group. So we made it a parade, and that way we can have everybody's participation.
Okay, and so for we do have a national audience here, but if you happen to be in Toronto, September the 9th at 9:30 in the morning, Trinity Bellwoods Park, and they'll be ending the parade at the Toronto Vegetarian Association Food Festival. So that sounds like a lot of fun. I see some hands waving in the other room there. I think you may have at least one of our volunteers attending. So let's move on exactly to kind of what the idea behind your group here was. It seems you've made it very, very clear that the focus of the specific issue that kind of cascades to all the other issues here is that you want to focus on the problem of overconsumption. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Sure. I think when we discuss environmental issues in the media, in society, amongst people, there's so much, there's so many opinions, so many different issues that people talk about. There's a lot of noise, and there's a lot of greenwashing, and people trying to sell you stuff or pass a policy and tell you that it's green and whatnot. But in most cases, people don't really focus on what is the root cause of all the problems in the first place. What is the main cause? And we want to take a look critically at environmental problems, and clearly the main problem is that we consume far too much as human beings. We consume far too much, and that's where all the problems stem from. And when we want to try and solve environmental problems, we have to look at the fact that we consume too much. And when we're talking about any kind of solution at all, we have to look at the arithmetic, look at the math, look at the science behind it, and think about how this affects consumption. In many cases, when people have proposed a policy or say that something is green or not green, they're not looking at actually, how much our current practice consumes and this alternative practice that whatever they're doing may consume. And in many cases, some green proposals may actually be worse for the environment, and they're not looking at consumption as a whole.
I think one of the kind of key examples of that we've had in the last few years was previous to American President Obama, we had, the junior Bush president. And one of the things he kind of put through as a placation to the environmental community there was the corn subsidy there, trying to, develop alternative fuels and stuff like that, which is, on its face, if you don't really know about the issue, sounds fantastic, but was actually a sort of a disastrous policy.
Absolutely. When I heard about these kind of things coming down the line, even before they were passed, I looked at, I thought about it, and I immediately knew that this was going to be a disaster, And because, the amount of fuel that we consume, the amount of energy we consume is enormous. Now, if we want to start changing land, that grows food to grow fuel, and it's just going to take far more land and divert food from people and into, cars, basically.
Mm-hmm. One of the key issues here, you're focusing on overconsumption, which I agree is one of the absolute linchpin issues here when we're talking about the environment, but it is also the kind of perhaps misunderstood, perhaps not misunderstood, issues of where you sort of lose a lot of people, not you personally, but where environmentalists kind of lose a lot of the unconvinced, or at least unexcited, because it's, see, that idea seems to go in the face of the idea of how our entire economy works. You know, people say, well, if we don't consume, then the economy collapses. And I think that's where you get that either, you know, potentially in, you know, in some cases understanding, or I think in generally in most cases misunderstanding of how, you know, promoting or protecting the environment is in direct conflict of us, you know, having a good economy and having good jobs. Do you agree with that? Is that a real concern?
That is a real concern. That is a real concern. The issue is a concern. But, you know, when we talk about consumption, when we talk about overconsumption, we also have to talk about the alternatives to overconsumption. So, you know, what our organization wants to do is we want to talk about, okay, so overconsumption is the main problem. What are the main causes of overconsumption, right? If we want to break that down, where do we overconsume the most? And if we look at that scientifically, then we can approach those things in a proper way. But then what does the alternative look like? Okay, if we have an economic model right now that proposes that we have unlimited growth, that's kind of the model that we have, and if we have a model where we think that you just have to consume as much as possible so that we can keep consuming as much as possible, right? Consumption drives more consumption because it's going to be always good for the economy. The economy always grows, and we always, you know, that is a certain type of model. But that model has terrible environmental consequences, but also has terrible human consequences, right? What would an alternative be that? An alternative, what would be the good alternative to that? So one of the main things that we want to discuss in our organization is environmental economics and a way of life that would be happy, healthy, you know, vibrant for people, meet human needs, and be probably a lot healthier for people in many ways, healthier and happier, but at the same time, consume a lot less. So we do need a different economic model. And this is a very, very key point, because the thing is that when you have a systemic change in the model that we use and that it applies to everybody, that's when net consumption will decrease. Otherwise, you have sort of people doing voluntary actions out of the goodness of their heart, which are important, but you don't have this sort of systemic change in behavior of people.
Mm-hmm. It almost requires at this point, when you're talking about economics, one of the key kind of factors to describe any of it is the idea of incentives. And I find that viewing things through the lens of what the incentives are to be an extremely useful way to sort of understand a lot of our, you know, problems with having to do with anything having to do with the economy. However, here, when I was reading through your organizational overview, right at the beginning, it says you want to deal with, sort of issues that are neglected or unrealistically treated in both environmental debate in politics and in society and also in public education. And so immediately in the back of my head went off a little light saying, aha, I wonder if he tackled the one that's my sort of pet issue that I feel is kind of the most feared. And to my happy surprise, you did, which is that the kind of X factor in all of these calculations of environmental impact and economy and why we need to kind of be constantly growing the economy, it's not intrinsically that. It's because the population is constantly growing. And I'm so happy to see that you were kind of not scared of tackling that idea of population. I mean, you say right here in your overview, population management, which, I mean, is two words when put together has very scary implications for people, and I think makes people back off, because then immediately you start, you know, having visions, or at least some people might start having visions of, global one Chinese style one child policy, or telling people, you know, it has sort of implications or scary visions of very draconian governments and having your life run and all these regulations and stuff. How do you deal with that issue? What sort of ideas do you have around discussing the idea of population in general?
Sure. So again, you know, when we look at the major factors that drive the world's consumption, population is a major factor. And now, it's not just population. I one of the things that I want to discuss with people, and the way we're going to discuss it, we're going to have education materials developed that will be put on our website, and there's also, I have the intention of writing a book about overconsumption as well. I call it the population consumption equation or something like that. I sort of developing a name for it, but I'm sure it's an idea that I didn't think of that other people thought of too. You know, the total consumption equals the population multiplied by per person consumption, right? And that gives you total consumption, right? You can break that down and look at subpopulations and look at a subpopulation and say, look at that population, multiply that by the per person consumption on average, and then you'll see the total consumption. So you can look at the Canadian population, how many people there are, multiplied by the, you know, average consumption, and then, you know, and then come up with how, you know, how much we consume. You can do that for other countries. You can also do that for subpopulations. What do you know, the top 10% of Canadians versus the bottom 10%? You know, you can do this kind of analysis, who's consuming what, and that's a really important thing to do. Now, when it comes to population, looking at things scientifically, I mean, I can't comment too much about China's policies. I don't know enough about them. But when you study internationally and you look at research, you know, population is not decreased by taking away people's rights. Population is decreased by giving people their rights. Okay, and that's a really important concept. So the factors that affect population growth the most are the education of people. The higher people are educated, the better people are educated, the less children they tend to have. And there's pretty much, in some papers that I've read, more than double the impact by educating girls. So the more a girl, a female, girls, women are educated, the when they grow up and when it's time for them to have kids, they delay their first pregnancy much more. They tend to have less kids, and they have the personal desire to have less kids and you know, bring them up in a different way, you know, because they're so much more empowered to do so. It also affects many other things. You know, women's rights increase the more that they are educated, you know, and whether it's violence against women or women's economic rights, you know, the more they're educated, the more they're able to have a better quality of life for themselves and their families. This goes for boys, too. We want to educate boys, too, but there's a bigger impact on girls. And we know that globally that girls aren't getting as much chance at education as boys are. So we want to, of course, you know, promote both, but this is the, you know, also other factors are maternal child health. So the better survival rates there are for mothers and their babies, the less children people tend to have. And there's many factors amongst there that we could probably talk about. One of the main things probably is the fact that, you know, people have a lot of kids in developing countries or other places because they feel that, you know, somebody may not survive, something may happen to them, we better have more kids because that way we'll be able to take care of each other. They'll take care of us, we'll take care of them, they'll take care of each other, all those kind of things. They'll take care of the extended family too. When people have a security that we're going to be healthy, we're going to survive, then people have less, you know, less kids. Economic development. When people have a basic economic development, that doesn't mean an economic development to the level of Canada where we have to have so much material stuff. But when people have some basic economic security, they tend to feel laid back. Listen, my kids are going to survive. We're educated. At least we're like literate. We've, you know, got some sort of an education that we can that helps us out in our life. That, again, those factors all accumulate, and people then have less and less kids without any interference by anybody else. You know, without any policies or anything like that that are imposed by the government regarding having less kids.
Yes, one of the things that has been mentioned in many, many classes that I've taken was the idea, or, you know, you see it as kind of a meme picture that gets sent around and stuff like that about where, you know, if everyone in the world lived with the kind of consumption, the levels of consumption, energy use, you know, everything across the board, the way that North Americans did, we'd need, you know, something like seven Earths or something like that to be able to sustain it. One of the things that, just exactly to what you were saying here, that isn't factored into that number was that Canada's population without immigration from a lot of these countries that have much higher rates of childbirth than we do for the reasons that you just outlined, as soon as they come to Canada, the population decreases very rapidly as soon as they kind of get into this place, exactly as you said, where better reliability, they don't need to worry about, you know, having seven kids because, you know, four of them are very realistically might die before the age of 10 or 15. And that isn't really factored into that in number. So yes, I mean, you know, we don't need to all consume. There's no need for us all to consume the way that North Americans do, and we definitely need to reduce our consumption. But without immigration from these other countries, just Canadian born childbirth would drop off a cliff. Our population would actually shrink very fast if we cut off all immigration, because Canadians don't actually reproduce enough to keep up our population on their own. Which I think plays a very important factor into some of the issues that you're talking about education and different lenses through which these issues that can be dealt with, especially when you're trying to deal with some of these tough issues that, like population, that people just really, you know, they get very uneasy when they even come up in conversation.
People do get very uneasy, and we have to realize that, you know, it's just interesting the way that the universe sort of conspires that, you know, good things create good things, and you know, acting, you know, when we try to promote responsible, compassionate things that empower people in developing countries, that's really what's going to, you know, cause a population shift that's, you know, going to get a decreased population. When we promote things that cause instability, lack of education, lack of people's rights, you know, people react by having more kids. You know, so it's you know, it's not about us, you know, enforcing any kind of negative, you know, constricting policy that takes away people's rights. It really is about, you know, being compassionate and doing things in a very sort of responsible way that that looks at the research around education, women's rights, maternal child health, you know, and sustainable economic development for people in developing countries.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we're very much out of time here. We're running right up against the end of the program. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Tushar Mehta, who prefers to go by Tushar. If you're interested in joining their run, you can look at, if you're in Toronto, you can look at runfortheearth.org. There's also a Facebook page and a Twitter feed for that, also under Run for the Earth. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, and I hope to see you there. And remember, it's a walk, it's a parade. We're not running, so everybody is invited, and everybody can be there, even if you're in a wheelchair. Come on.
Absolutely. All right. Technical production today was by Ryan Knight, web hosting and bandwidth for our podcast provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcript of our news headlines sometime in the future when we get greenmajority.ca back up and running. For now, stay tuned to the Facebook fan page, and always, of course, feel free to email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. You've been listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all environmental news hour. Until next week, thanks for listening.